OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Terumah, which is also Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon, the first of two Adars we have this year. Rosh Chodesh begins tonight. Let me tell you what tonight is first. Today, recording and first broadcast, is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 29th of the month of Shavat. On the secular calendar, the 3rd of February. The 29th is always the day before Rosh Chodesh. Sometimes it's a two-day Rosh Chodesh when the month has 30 days, which Shavat has, and sometimes one-day Rosh Chodesh in the case of a month that has only 29 days. So the day following the 29th and the 1st of the month are Rosh Chodesh. Sometimes that's a single day, and sometimes it's two. Tonight, Thursday night, tomorrow, Friday, Erev Shabbat, Friday night and Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh, Adar HaRishon, the first of the two Adars. So we will talk about that also, if we get to it, probably not. And because it's already Mincha time of Rosh Chodesh, we don't say Tachanun, and therefore we will do Psalm 121 rather than Psalm 130. Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph. Shir Lama'alot Esa Einai El Heharim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri Me'im Adonai Osei Shamayim Va'aretz. Al Yitain Lamot Raglecha Al Yanum Shomerecha. Hine Lo Yanum Velo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yaminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach balayla. Adonai yishmarcha mikol ra yishmaret nafshecha. Adonai yishmar tzeitecha uvoecha me'ata v'ad olam. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha. ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Now, even though I said before that I hope to get to Rosh Chodesh stuff, I don't really know how much time there will be because I gave quite a long shear to the folders a short while ago, minutes, and I really feel that that is the subject that has to be presented for this particular parsha of Terumah. So we will have that. It'll be broken up at the midpoint. And if there's any time towards the end, I will throw in a couple of words about two Rosh Chodeshes. Otherwise, we'll do some of that in Mirtz Hashem next week. But for now, the shiur just finished to the folders of Torah Tidbits, and we'll see whatever time we have left. Birshutchem, with your permission. Side point already. Birshutchem, or Birshut, is said when people make hamotzi for other people. And there's a little tiny halachic objection to saying it when people usually do, because they've washed for hamotzi, and they have not yet said hamotzi, and you're really not supposed to interrupt in that part for anything. I take back for anything. There are things that that one can interrupt for, but some suggest that birshutchem is not a necessary interruption. Funny that where's the salt? Even though people usually gesture, you're actually allowed to say. Train of thought to the train of thought. In shul, before the Amidah begins, when there is a special thing to add, for example, Yalla V'Yavo on Rosh Chodesh, it's very common for the Gabbai to clap, bang his hand down on the Shulchan, and that's a reminder for whatever you remember that it's supposed to remind you of. Now, at Shacharit, that's the best you could do. But at Mincha, there's no reason not to say Yalla V'Yavo when it's Rosh Chodesh, because it's at a point where you're allowed to talk. Yet it's so ingrained that you have to bang to remind people that people forget to say, remember Yalla V'Yavo, and instead they clap. Ma'ariv is not as free to talk as Mincha, but it's not as restrictive as Shacharit. And one of the things that specifically is mentioned in the codes is that you can say Yalla V'Yavo. In other words, the announcement of Yalla V'Yavo. Yet, many people still clap. And the funniest thing is, when it's Chanukah and Rosh Chodesh, they clap twice. One for Yalla V'Yavo, one for Al HaNisim. And you have to figure out, because the claps don't sound any different. Last side point before I get onto the main track. I went to Crown Heights Yeshiva Elementary School. They had a shul. The shul is the only place I've ever seen this, but apparently it was the style. Had a rectangular pillow with a hard center covered in leather and a clopper, a tool which looks sort of like a cutting board with a handle, you know, a paddle. And the gabbai, or the shamus, used to bang on that, and you didn't forget to remember whatever they wanted you to remember, a very, very loud clop. So that was sort of like a funny thing when you could just bang your hand on the shulchan, and that works, but they had an official shul clopper, whatever it was called. Anyway, when you get to read Torah Tidbits, you will find that there is more than one person and one angle explored on a very significant question about the main theme of Parshat Terumah. The main theme is the Mishkan. Va'asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham. Make for me a mikdash, a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. Now, the first obvious question is, had it said, make for me a mikdash and I will dwell in it, then you would have, on the one hand, the logic would be in favor of that wording, but the question would be, what does God need a house for? When the wording is, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them, among you, then the logic of the pasuk doesn't ring, but it does answer the question that we're not talking about building a house for God, because he doesn't need a house. We're talking about doing something, the result of which will be his dwelling among us. So the question doesn't disappear, but it shifts. The question is, okay, what do we have to build a sanctuary, a house, a Beit HaMikdash, a Mishkan, whatever you want to call it, for God, in order for him to dwell among us? Why is that a necessary thing, a prerequisite? Is it a prerequisite? Is there no way that God dwells among the Jewish people unless we build a Mishkan? So the question is, what's going on? What confounds the question and strengthens the question is the fact that the entire parsha of Terumah and much of Tetzaveh and the beginning of Ki Tisa are loaded loaded with detail about the Mishkan, extreme detail. I'll give you just an extreme example. In describing the menorah, it describes that there is a sphere, an orb, on the menorah at the base of two facing branches. One sphere, aside from what's on the branches themselves and on the main stalk, where the branches meet the main stalk of the menorah, they meet in a sphere. It's called a kaftor. Even though we use the word kaftor for button, it means an orb. The pasuk says there shall be one orb under two branches, one orb under another pair of two branches, one orb under the third pair of two branches, orbs under each of the six branches. Now, aside from the important math lesson of 2 plus 2 plus 2 equals 6, it's a very strange pasuk. Because there are other psukim which say what's to be done about one thing, and then it says, and do that to the others. But it doesn't say, do it for this, do it for this, do it for this, do it for all of them, when you just counted out all of them. Extreme detail. I'm not going to answer that because I don't have a good answer for that. And I will, if I have time over Shabbat, I'll look it up. But the point is, the detail is extreme. Especially when you compare it about many other areas of Torah where the details are quite scant. Shabbat. Thou shalt not do any manner of melacha. 39 categories of melacha are not spelled out by the Torah. The process by which things are defined as being one of those violations, the derivatives of those violations, this is all part of the oral law. And that could have been the same thing with the Mishkan. You didn't need the extreme detail. It could have been part of Torah Sheba'al Peh. I'll go you one step further. The Mishkan was 39 of the 40 years in the wilderness. It was redone in Eretz Yisrael in a few places with different, same dimensions, but different material. I mean, the major difference was that in the Midbar, the wall boards were made of wood plated with gold. And in Shiloh, for example, the walls were stone with the same dimension as the wall boards of the Midbar. And the coverings were the same, and the furnishings were the same aron, the same shulchan, the same menorah, the same mizbeach, but the walls were different. So the details in the Torah were not even details forever, for future fulfillment of the mitzvah to build a mikdash. They were, some of them, a one-shot deal. And yet there was detail. What compounds the question even more is that after going through all of the detail, as God commands Moshe to tell the people, that in Teruma, Tetzave, and the beginning of Kitisa, in Vayakel and Pekudei, we have the detail again. That pasuk that I referred to, which says, one orb under two branches, one orb under two branches, one orb under two branches, six branches with orbs under them, that's repeated in Vayakhel, as well as all the other detail, with very, very little difference. Whenever there's a difference, the Mefarshim pounce on it. And the question now becomes not just why so much detail, but why so much detail twice? And even before, why so much detail? Why is a house for God needed in order to bring him among us when he doesn't live in that house anyway? Something like that. Now, I don't have the answers. I don't have the time for the answers, even the parts that I do. I have an idea which I want to share. And I need to give you a little bit more background, or as Shmuel Golden in Torah Tibbetz calls it, context. Between the detail of the Mishkan and the garments of the Kohen and the Mizbeach and the Menorah and all of that stuff in Teruma, Tetzaveh, and the beginning of Kitisa, and the repeat of those details in Vayakhel and Pekudei, something which we all know about happens in Parshat Kitisa. Everything is ready. And that's where you realize that God has been transmitting this, as well as the rest of the Torah, to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. What were the people doing during that time? We don't know. They were waiting for Moshe to come back. I imagine they had various and sundry day-to-day activities that kept them busy. It was on the 40th day that they got a little itchy. Where's Moshe? He's supposed to be back by now. So they thought, where's Moshe? Where's Moshe? And that resulted, not in this week's Sedra, but two Sedras from now in Kitisa, it resulted in the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. The golden calf is described, and we also find God saying to Moshe, after all that I have explained to you, that you have to tell the people, take these two stone tablets and go down to the people, and now go down and see what they've done. So Moshe comes down, instead of with a smile on his face, with a radiance from having been on Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, carrying the two luchot, which is like the down payment on the whole Torah which they were to receive. Instead, he drops them or throws them down, breaking them, castigating the people, destroying the Egel, punishing those that actually reveled in the calf, and warning the people that he is now going back up to Har Sinai in the hopes that God will forgive the people. Especially the fence sitters, the actual revelers in golden calf, whatever that means, they were not around. They were killed. 3,000 men. 3,000 out of more than 600,000 is less than half of a percent. That's not a lot. Less than one half of a percent of the male population. You add in women and the percentage goes even further down, since women did not participate in Egel HaZahav. And yet, all the people now are accountable for what was done, which they didn't put a stop to. One of their first tasks after Moshe comes back down is to build the Mishkan, to collect the materials, which they did with enthusiasm, and to build the Mishkan, which they did. Detail, detail, detail. This creates the question, wait a minute, is the concept of a mikdash, a physical entity with holiness and with a whole complex seder avoda, order of service, is this what was supposed to be in the first place, or is this a response by God to the golden calf? That's the question that a lot of Mefarshim handle. That's a question that in the written Torah Tidbits this week, it's discussed a lot. And that's what I want to add my 2 cents to now, in addition to the 2 cents or more that I put into Torah Tidbits in writing. The approach that I am comfortable with is that God does not get surprised by anything that we do. That he didn't say up front nothing about a Mishkan, and then because of the terrible, terrible sin of the golden calf, he says, I better come up with something to channel their need for a focus and a physical focal point of their spiritual energies. Oh, I got it. Make a Mishkan and make an Aron in it and put cherubs on the Aron and put the Luchot inside the Aron and do this with a Shulchan and do this with Menorah. It was not an afterthought. When people came, I'm jumping ahead now, to complain to Moshe that since they were Tamei for good reasons, they weren't able to participate in the first annual Korban Pesach, and I said it was not fair that we were left out. The command of Pesach Sheni is presented in the Torah, and the question is, was this an afterthought on God's part, or was this part of the plan? I believe it was part of the plan. There are opinions otherwise, but I believe that God does not get surprised. The plan was Pesach Sheni. It was not revealed to the people until the episode of the individuals who came to complain. When the daughters of Tzelophchad, this is even further on, came to Moshe and the people, and they said, hey, our father had 5 daughters and no sons, and you're planning on going into Eretz Yisrael and giving out land according to the people who came out of Egypt, and that qualifies our father, who's no longer alive, and even our grandfather, Hefer, were both in the right age category with coming out of Egypt, and their descendants deserve a portion in the land. But they didn't have male descendants. It's just us. It's not fair. As a result, the Torah presents the laws of inheritance, which say a man is inherited by his sons, and if there are no sons, the daughters inherit. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Teruma, which this year is also Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon, also known as Adar Aleph. We're in the middle of the mini shir, actually a midi shir, given to the folders earlier this afternoon. As a result, the Torah presents the laws of inheritance, which say a man is inherited by his sons, and if there are no sons, the daughters inherit. Was this an afterthought where God said to Moshe, look, these feminists are complaining, maybe we should give them land and make the rules? I don't believe that. I believe that the laws of inheritance, just like the laws of Pesach Sheni, just like the laws of Shabbat and the laws of Kashrut and the laws of the holidays, were all given by God to Moshe at Sinai. It doesn't mean that we knew everything at one snap of a finger. It was a process of learning, being taught, and being exposed to these things. So the Pesach Sheni episode was initiated by the people who were Tamei the first time around. The inheritance issue was stimulated, triggered by the daughters of Tzelophchad, but it doesn't mean that that wasn't going to be the rule in the first place. It is also, seems from the presentation in the Torah, that the Mishkan is it fits well as a reaction to the Chet HaEgel, But that can't be all that it was supposed to be. Now the answer, still not up to my extra point, but we're getting there. The answer that I have is that it's possible to have meant to give this even without a chet ha'egel, without a sin of a golden calf. And that's why the Torah presents it in this week's Sedra, next week in the beginning of Kitisa, before the Torah tells us about the incident of the golden calf. Because the way that you're supposed to look at Mishkan, at Mikdash, is from the pure perspective of, we came out of Egypt, we crossed through the sea, we stood at Har Sinai to receive the Torah, we set up civil laws in Parshat Mishpatim, how to go day by day, and then we are presented with a lofty task of making a sanctuary for God, so that he will dwell among us, not answering yet the other questions. But then, before we got there, Chet HaEgel happened. And the actual carrying out of making the Mishkan was in the background, not of the lofty, beautiful background that was Har Sinai and Yam Suf and Yetziat Mitzrayim, but now the background is the black episode of the golden calf. That doesn't contradict. It could be exactly both, and the analogy that I give in the lead tidbit is to parents who buy their son a gift of a computer with very nice software, and they figure, let's not give it to him yet, let's put it away for a couple of weeks till his birthday. In the meantime, they get called down to school that the kid is failing and is disruptive in class, and the principal makes the following recommendation. It would be a good idea if you got him a computer with software that I would recommend to help him in the subjects that he's failing, and maybe he'll change his attitude and his behavior. Now, the parents said, you wouldn't believe this, but we already got him a computer. We just haven't told him about it yet and haven't given it to him yet. Now they give it to him, and what's his feeling? You were called down by the principal. I did bad things in school and I failed. We did the golden calf. And that's why I'm getting a computer to do remedial work. The parents are going to tell him somewhere along the line, true, you did a bad thing, and you were failing, and you could have done better, and we got you this computer in order to be able to help you improve and become a better person, but now I want you to know something. We got this computer 2 weeks before the principal called us into the office. We didn't know anything about you doing poorly in school. We thought you were everything was fine. So we want you to know that you would have gotten this computer even without the episodes in school. And you should think of it in that term, not just of a negative kind of thing. Now I'll go a little bit into the other questions that I opened up in the beginning. Does God need a house? Definitely not. Not when we say, Melo Chol Ha'aretz Kvodo. The whole universe is filled with his glory. He doesn't need a house. If anything, we speak of God in heaven, even though the song you teach little kids is, Hashem is here, Hashem is there. You know that one? Hashem is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, down, right, left. I don't even remember how it goes. Hashem is all around. So he doesn't need a Beit HaMikdash. We need a Beit HaMikdash. Now the question is, why do we need a Beit HaMikdash? Is it because of the golden calf that we need a Beit HaMikdash? Some commentaries say that. But I think, as others suggest, I think it's not because of Egel HaZahav, it's because we are human beings. And human beings need focuses and symbols and physical structures and objects to help channel their religious energies where they should be going. But there are limits. Can you make an idol that represents God? Chas v'chalila, God forbid. That's idolatry. We don't believe in that. Not only don't we believe in that, we're forbidden very seriously not to do that kind of stuff. All right, so what about other levels of an object? Of course we have objects. We have a Ner Tamid in Shul. We don't worship the Ner Tamid, the eternal light. We don't bow to it, we don't pray to it, but it's there. It's there as a reminder of the eternal fire on the Mizbeach, and that leads to feelings of the eternal commitment of a Jew to God. We need that in order to have this commitment. Yeah, we're human beings. And human beings have a very difficult time working in abstract concepts, in intangible kind of things, and in unknowing things. And when did we demonstrate that we were human? Cheta ego. The sin of the golden calf, I believe, is less of a sin and more of a manifestation that we are human beings and we have a very difficult time towing the mark. Because it's not something that comes natural to us. Let me jump again. Parshat Vo'etchanan. Moshe Rabbeinu is in the process of his final period of time being the leader of the people, and he's talking to them. And one of the things he says, I am very concerned that you will see things in nature, magnificent animals, or tall, lofty trees, or mountains, or the sun in the sky, and the moon, and the stars, and you will worship them. Now, why would he think that? Why would that be a possibility? You know why? Because on the day of revelation at Sinai, you did not see anything, because you can't see God. And that frustrates the average human being. Let's say it frustrates any human being. The idea, not only of not seeing God, but not being able to see Him, and His not being seeable, is a hard concept to take. So we have symbols, not chas v'cholila, idols that replace worship of Him, or even help us worship Him, but we have, let's call it kosher physical objects, as long as we keep it within guidelines. A Torah is respected, it is not worshipped. The Kotel is a reminder of something, but you don't daven to the Kotel. If you think you do, you've got a big problem. You daven to God. So what do I need a Kotel for? You need it to stand there and be awestruck by the reminder of the Beit HaMikdash. Why do I need a Kever Rachel to daven? Are we asking Rachel Imenu? No, we're not davening to Rachel Imenu. You're not allowed to daven to people. We are davening to God at this very inspiring and sensitive location. And that's a human need. Could human beings, could Jews, could each of us get to that close, special feeling of God and manifest it through prayer and through meditation without an object to focus on? I don't know if that's possible. We have symbols. Reminders. We're loaded with them. The only warning is don't go too far with them. You don't pray to Rachel. You don't worship her. You don't venerate Kever Rachel. You respect it and you are inspired by it. the same thing for going on to Har HaBayit, the same thing for the Beit HaMikdash, which was and will be. It is not an object of worship. It is a kosher vehicle by which human beings can reach certain spiritual heights. And certainly the average person can't without them. I don't know how many belong to that exclusive group, but let me digress, not really digress, to show you how what I'm trying to say. My grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, had a colleague and friend who was also a friend of my father's, who I got to know as well. And I am proud to say that I was the third generation Chernovsky to argue with this fellow about Judaism, about Torah. He was Jewish, not religious in the sense that we would say. And he told me once that mitzvot are important for many people, and he pointed to me and said, and you too, but he's beyond mitzvot. What do you mean you're beyond mitzvot? He said, I have developed a close personal relationship with God without the need to wear tefillin, to keep Shabbat, to fast on Yom Kippur, to pray. None of that. It's all necessary for you and many other Jews, but he has achieved the goal of oneness with God without it. So I spent hours with the guy discussing and arguing and trying all kind of angles. A major angle being that the performance of mitzvot is not just a way to get closer to God. That's one of its goals. But it also has a goal in and of itself, the fulfillment of a mitzvah. And whatever. Then I said to him something at the end. I said, okay, you know what? Let's jump to another aspect of what you've been saying. Let's say you have a close relationship with God, which, by the way, he told me he got through jogging and listening to Mishnayot tapes that somebody had once given him, and meditating. I said, let's say you got close to God. How are you going to transmit it to your children? He looks me straight in the eye and he says, it took me a long time to get my relationship with God. I can't spend the energies for my children. They'll have to do it themselves. At that point, I said to him, that is the most non-Jewish thing that I have ever heard, because Judaism is based upon exactly the opposite. Parents going out of their way and sacrificing in order to give their children all the necessary materials and concepts to be good Jews. Not to say, you're on your own, kid. Terrible. The mitzvah to learn Torah. Do you know how the Torah says it? Mitzvah to learn Torah. Every Jew has to learn Torah. In what words does the Torah say that? Vishinantam livanecha. You teach your children. Teach the next generation. That means to learn Torah. Why didn't the Torah say learn Torah? Because it did not want you to lose sight for one moment of the obligation of transmitting this to your children. And one of the ways, the best way that children learn is not just by jogging and meditation, but by symbols, by observances, by mitzvot. When a child sees candles in nice candlesticks for Shabbat, when he sees a sitter, when he sees his father in tallis and tefillin, all of these things, when he sees a Torah, when he's brought up even before he understands it, to kiss the Torah. And then that's nurtured through his formative years. That's how Judaism gets transmitted. it is not a failing to need objects. It would be a failing only if we take the proper respect and honor for objects to the forbidden step beyond of veneration. That's the warning that goes with this. So I think the Torah went out of its way to give us the full detail of the Mishkan before we hear or read a word about the Egel HaZahav. After the episode of the Egel, instead of saying the Jews did what they had been commanded, it goes through the detail again, saying it's important to keep in mind that this Egel HaZahav episode, more than being a sin, I mentioned that before, is a definition, a demonstration, a manifestation of how human beings function. I was always struck with golden calf, terrible, two cherubs fashioned out of gold on the lid of the Aron, big mitzvah. What's the difference? The answer is all the difference in the world. The first was a violation of God's law. The second is a fulfillment of God's command. And we shouldn't be stuck with a feeling of paradox, of contradiction here, because it's not. God says there are proper, kosher symbols that you should do, that you should make, that you should have as part of your religious observances, and there are things that you're not allowed to do, even if they help. If a person says to you, I really can't handle this business of an infinite God. It doesn't speak to me. But you know what does? The sun. Hot, powerful, light, can't look at it, giving energy, and then you learned in science that trees grow because of sunlight and plants and people, and it gives life to the world. That I could relate to. So you know what? I will believe in God that He created the world, including the sun, but I will relate to the sun and only through that to God. That's avodah zarah. That's idolatry. That we're not supposed to do. You want to use the sun as a symbol of the things that God created in nature that help people? Fine. But you don't worship it. Trees are wonderful things if you keep them in perspective. In fact, every time we eat a fruit that comes from a tree, we have a special bracha for it. And when we see fruit trees flowering the first time in Nisan, we have a bracha for that. And when we see beautiful forests that are not usual for us to see, and we're overwhelmed with the image, there's a bracha to say. But take a tree and make it an object of worship, that's called Asherah. We're not allowed to do that. We're not even allowed to plant a tree next to the Mizbeach on Har HaBayit, because people shouldn't even get close to that. But notice, it never tells us, don't think of trees. Think of trees. Think of how beautiful trees are, how special they are. Thank God for them. Do like Joyce Kilmer says in his poem about any fool can make a poem, but only God can make a tree. That's fine. Don't worship the tree. Worship God. We don't worship the Beit HaMikdash. We worship in the Beit HaMikdash. We let it inspire us no matter where we are and no matter when we are. That's what happened. The Beit HaMikdash continues to inspire Jewish observances and prayers, even though it hasn't existed in close to 2,000 years. But that doesn't mean that it won't be even a more powerful focus of our energies in Yirtzeh Hashem, when the third Beit HaMikdash is built, b'mheirah v'yameinu. With that, I have about a minute to talk about the two Adars. We spoke last week, and we will talk Yirtzeh Hashem in coming weeks. we know in advance in our fixed calendar which years are scheduled to be two Adars. It's not a surprise, even in the olden times and the future of Sanhedrin. It's not a total surprise. People will be able to calculate on their own and predict with different amounts of certainty whether a particular year will be a Shana Me'uberet, a two Adar 13-month year or not. But now it's a simple pattern in any given 19-year cycle. Years 3, 6, 8, 11, 14, 17, and 19 are two Adars. This year is the 14th year of the 304th cycle since creation. And that's the story. We have two Adars. The first one starts this Rosh Chodesh. That's about it for this week's Torah Tidbits audio. I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, l'hishtameah.